Who's this? Oh, that's a candy
wrapper. That's a candy wrapper, yeah.
Please be wrong about being a member of Ducks Unlimited.
Well, see, I'm on the side.
The Senate Judiciary and Public Safety Committee will reconvene for the record Friday, April 29th, 2011. Mr. Arrest, is your bill first?
Yeah.
Of course it's first. Senator Arrest, welcome back to the Judiciary Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members, and for hearing Senate File 1306. Which will provide.
Senator Rest, could you pull that microphone real
yes,
close?
I'm sorry.
You're such a soft spoken person.
Right. Senate File 1306 is a bill that does not make any substantive changes to the Minnesota State Tax Code, although it does indeed deal with that. And what it tries and or what it is a proposal to do is to make sure that people are able to make the best decisions that they can under the changes that have been made to the federal law with regard to estates. There was an opportunity, or there was a change made in 2010 in Minnesota to deal with changes that had been made in 2009 and giving some estates and estate planners an option to make sure that their wishes were carried out. And what was not anticipated is that there were going to be some additional changes made at the federal level in 2010, which then put up in the air the planning being done in Minnesota. And so what this bill does is to make sure that those federal changes do not lead to uncertainty and unnecessary litigation in Minnesota. It is a bill that is supported by the Minnesota Bar Association, and we will give or have, and I hope you'll welcome testimony in that regard. And I think you also have an explanation in your packets of what the issues were, the timeliness of it, and then why we need an additional solution in 2011 to have an impact on options that could have been chosen in 2010.
Is there anyone else here to give testimony to the bill?
Mr. Chair.
Could you identify yourself for the record?
My name is Andrew M. Basie. I'm an attorney with Briggs & Morgan. I'm also the co-chair of the Legislative Committee for the Probate and Trust section of the Minnesota State Bar.
Welcome to the committee. Please proceed.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, this is a simple technical clarification. It's with regard to definitions that are used when a will or trust references a term that is defined in the federal estate tax code. Will and trusts oftentimes use a funding formula that uses terms defined in the federal tax law, such as referencing the federal estate tax exemption. During most of 2010, as you know, the federal estate tax laws were repealed, so Minnesota had wills and trusts that were now referencing definitions that didn't exist. This caused great confusion. Last year, the legislature fixed the problem by passing a law that said all such references were deemed to refer to the federal provisions and definitions that were in effect at the end of 2009, prior to the repeal of the federal estate tax law. The law that the legislature passed last year, the Minnesota legislature passed, was set to automatically expire to the extent that the federal estate tax scheme became effective in 2010. As we know, a new federal estate tax was enacted mid-December of 2010. It was retroactively applied to January 1 of 2010, but it was optional, giving estates the option to opt into the new federal estate tax or continue under the regime where there was no federal estate tax. It's because of that optional portion of what was passed that it is unclear what the fix that the Minnesota legislature put in last year, which definitions apply. The bill that is being proposed clarifies that the 2009 federal definitions that were in place should be used for decedents that die in 2010. This just affects decedents that die in 2010. An additional fix is put in for a small number of decedents that may have had a contrary intention, and if that intention is shown not to be tied to those 2009 definitions, then the decedent's intent can be effectuated.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Basie. Any questions of the testifier? Is there anyone in the room that wishes to speak for or against the bill? Hearing none. And hearing no discussion. I would be open for a motion. Senator Hoffman moves that Senate File 1306 be recommended to pass and be moved to the floor.
It needs to go to taxes.
Taxes. We conferred with Tax Committee Administrator.
Mr. Chairman, I stand corrected. Ms. Cadoon has indicated that the Tax Committee does not need to see this in the Senate.
Senator Hoffman renews her motion that Senate File 1306 be recommended pass and be moved to the floor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails.
Thank you very
much. Thank you, Senator Ress. Senator Ingebrigtsen, Senate File 1082. Regarding driver license revocation for DWI convictions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair and members, I was approached by the Department of Public Safety to carry this particular bill, Senate File 1082, which is a technical change in the law that was passed last session. I'll just give you a little quick overview here of the information that I have with regards to it. It's a cleanup bill that in 2010 the legislature passed near unanimously, and the governor signed in a major and comprehensive law to combat drunk driving and the epidemic of unlicensed drivers in Minnesota. Under the law, Minnesota driver's license revocation periods were lengthened, but offenders desiring to follow the rules could legally license almost immediately, provided that they agree to have an ignition interlock device installed into their vehicle. By expanding Minnesota's very successful ignition interlock program, as many states have done, the offender can get back on the road sooner and with a legal license. And the public is safeguarded because the interlock prevents the car from starting if the driver has been drinking, and the courts are no longer flooded with the driving after suspension and revocation citations that they are plagued with. 2010 law was very complex and was given an effective date of July 31st, 2011 to allow time for rulemaking and other implementation steps. And to catch any fixes that needed to be prior to the effective date. We are here today because the Department of Public Safety has found one such cross-reference error in the law that must be corrected in order to enact the legislative intent. So I'd like to turn the discussion over to Ms. Kopinski of the Driver's Vehicle Division of Public Safety to explain further. And also I do have, I believe Senator Latz has a couple of amendments that or at least one for sure that he would like to offer, and those discussions have gone on with the department as well. So with that, I'll turn it over to Ms. Kopinski.
Perfect.
Kopinski?
Correct.
Please state your full name, please, and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, the 2010 DWI ignition interlock legislation was
excuse me, first, for the record, you have to identify yourself.
I'm sorry. I'm Joan Kopchinski, Driver Services Director, Department of Public Safety.
Thank you.
Thank you. The 2010 DWI ignition interlock legislation was passed to create effective administrative sanctions for impaired driving by creating a path for safe and legal driving for high-risk drivers through the use of ignition interlock. These high-risk drivers include first-time offenders with an alcohol concentration level of 0.16 and repeat DWI offenders. Senate File 1082 relates specifically to the mandatory revocation periods described in Minnesota Statute 169A.54 for first-time DWI offenders convicted of violating Minnesota Statute 169A.20, whose blood alcohol content is twice the legal limit, 0.16, but less than 0.20. The language is needed to implement DWI legislation regarding driver license sanctions for impaired driving and the use of ignition interlock as prescribed by the 2010 legislature. The current law fails to clearly define revocation periods for those convicted of violating Minnesota Statute 169A.20, whose blood alcohol content is twice the legal limit and less than 0.20. Senate File 1082 would eliminate ambiguity in the law regarding the length of revocation time for first-time DWI offenders and further aligns DWI law. Senate File 1082 clearly defines a one-year revocation period for a first-time conviction of a DWI if the offender's alcohol concentration level is twice the legal limit or greater.
Thank you, Senator Engelbrechtson.
I think there might be an amendment to this.
Senator. Mr. Chairman, I did have a question for Ms. Kopchinski real quickly. Could you explain again the relationship between the 0.16 and the 0.20 aspects of this bill?
Ms. Kopchinski.
What language is stating is that twice the legal limit, which is 0.08. So what we're looking for is the group of individuals whose blood alcohol concentration is twice the legal limit but less than 0.20, and rather than have a 30-day revocation, what we're asking for is that this aligns with the rest of the statute to actually cause a one-year revocation to the individual who's at 1.6 to 2.0, or twice the legal limit.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Lex.
I'm trying to remember back to last year's bill, because I know that there was an issue there relating to whether the threshold ought to be 0.20 and 0.16. Could you remind me, what did last year's bill do in connection with that?
Ms. Kopinski.
Mr. Chair and Senator Latz, what I'm reading is in subdivision 24A of the previous, of last year's legislation, which clearly defines twice the legal limit. I'm not sure, do you want me to explain the...
Senator Latz, perhaps
maybe counsel can help. Remind me of that detail,
Mr. Chair and Senator Latz. I mean, I think you're referring to. I think the initial proposal was to increase to make the lower the 2.0 in the criminal provisions of DWI to twice the legal limit, and that was not adopted. But last year's legislation did implement the revocation changes based on twice the limit, legal limit, which is 1.6. So that's what this bill tries to conform to.
Senator Latz.
So, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Backus, then this bill is not making any change with regard to the criminal part of it. It's just clarifying the language with regard to the 0.16 or twice the limit?
Mr. Chair and Senator Latz, that's correct. It makes no changes to the actual criminal standard for DWI. It just has to do with the license revocation changes.
Okay. And I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Latz.
Mr. Backus, what change does this bill do to the revocation period?
Mr. Backus.
Mr. Chair and Senator Latz, it just... My understanding is that there are a couple of cross-references that were missed in last year's ignition interlock bill that this bill fixes, so to speak.
But so with
Senator Letts,
with this clarification on the twice the legal limit provision, was there a kind of an anomaly there where you'd have a those with a 0.16 to 0.20 would have a different length of license revocation than otherwise, and this is just kind of clearing up that anomaly?
Mr. Backus.
Mr. Chair and Senator Letts, that's my understanding, yes.
So,
Senator Letts.
I guess I'm still trying to get a sense. Is this a policy change with regard to the length of the license revocation?
Ms. Kopensky.
Mr. Chair, Senator Letts, this was clearly the legislative intent. It was simply omitted in the language.
Okay. That's what I'm trying to get
Senator Letts.
Clear on. Thank you. Because that bill had so many moving parts and details that even in the middle of it, it was hard to keep track of everything. I do have an amendment I'd like to offer. It's the A3 amendment, please.
The A3 amendment is now being passed out. And while it's being passed out, Senator Letts, perhaps you could address it.
Thank you, members and Mr. Chair. The A3 amendment extends the ignition interlock program to those who have committed the offense of criminal vehicular operation resulting in bodily harm or substantial bodily harm to another. And it applies only to the criminal vehicular operation situations where alcohol was involved as an element of the offense that was committed. Currently, the CVO, or criminal vehicular operation statute, you can be charged with a CVO for, I don't know, 7 or 8 different categories. If you're driving a vehicle, you have had an accident and caused bodily harm, substantial bodily harm, serious bodily harm, or death. And then it's also differentiated by what conduct of yours was involved. If you were on drugs, if you were driving grossly, negligently, and a number of other criteria included in that list are the cases where you drove basically while under the influence of alcohol and caused the injury. The ignition interlock program is going to be successful and has been around the country. It has been in the pilot projects here precisely because of the fact that it can screen out or prevent those who have alcohol in their systems from driving. And in fact, there's so much confidence in its effectiveness that we have passed this law to become a permanent program in Minnesota and giving people their license back a lot earlier than they otherwise would get it back because of the confidence that we have in the safety that the ignition interlock will provide to the other drivers on the road. For someone who has an alcohol-related driving history or a significant alcohol-related offense beyond an ordinary misdemeanor DWI. So it extends that same theory now to driving offenses that also resulted in an accident with the lowest two categories of injury result. So it does not apply to CVOs where drugs were in the person's system. It does not apply to CVOs that were caused by gross negligence, extreme fatigue, for example, that might have caused someone to get into an accident and cause injury. Because the ignition interlock device would not subsequently protect the public from that kind of conduct. It also does not apply to cases where the results were great bodily harm or death. So it takes that narrow category, the lowest two levels of harm, and offenses where alcohol was related to it, and suggests that we can achieve the same or more public safety. Someone loses their license for a year, which is a mandatory minimum under CVO, without any waiting, without any work. Frankly, the odds of them driving to keep their jobs or take care of their families is much higher than it is if the revocation period is only for 30 days or 90 days or 6 months. So they're more likely to drive without a license. This would give them the license with the ignition interlock and thereby increase the public safety. So that's the intent of the amendment. My understanding is that the department supports the amendment, and I'd be happy to answer any questions about it. I'd ask for your support.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Latz, is there any cost or fiscal note associated with this?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not aware of any. I would suggest probably you'd end up with, if you took all the various working pieces, you'd probably end up with some savings out of it. There aren't that many CVOs in Minnesota, number one. Number two, you'd have people driving with valid licenses. So you probably reduce some of the driving after withdrawal charges that would result and end up in the district courts. I don't know that there'd be any significant additional work on the part of the department to implement it, just given the small numbers that would be involved.
Mr. Turner, do you have any opinion on that question?
Mr. Chairman, members, I don't see any fiscal impact to this. What few costs might be incurred would be picked up with savings elsewhere.
Senator Ingebrigtsen, do you have a comment on the amendment?
Mr. Chair, thank you. And I did talk to Senator Latz actually months ago already with regards to this, and I said I would work with him. He obviously has narrowed this thing down to a point where I think the department is okay with him. He's talked with him on it, and it should also be known, those that may or may not know, that the offender, the one that's going to be putting this unit in his car, he or she is going to be paying for this themselves. And we had a lot of discussion, as Senator Latz said last year, about this, so we accept it as a friendly amendment.
All right. Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Does anybody know the cost for something like this, and if I can have a follow-up?
Mr. Turner?
I was talking about the cost of the device that being put in.
Oh, we're on the amendment right now, Senator Hall.
Okay.
Any further discussion on the amendment? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Amendment is adopted. Senator Hall.
Well, the question is, the device that's being put in, what is that cost to the person that owns a car?
Senator Ingebrigtsen?
Mr.
Yes.
Chair, Senator Hall, the cost of installation is approximately $80 to $100, and the cost of maintenance, that would be the downloading of the data that's contained in the unit, would be anywhere, again, from $90 to $120 a month, depending on the vendor.
And follow-up?
Yes, Senator
Mr. Chair, and is it possible for that person to get around it? Is this a device you blow into? And so could a passenger blow into it instead and them still drive under the influence?
Ms. Kopinski.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hall, the device is built in such a way, or the device that the state has chosen to use for the program will actually have a camera, a small camera above the mirror, and so it'll be able to detect who actually has blown into the device. So if there is a question as to who used the vehicle and created the reading, the alcohol reading, it can be confirmed then based on the picture that will be taken.
Okay. Thank you.
As I'm looking at my other amendment here, I remember that it was drafted to amend the amendment that we just adopted. I would like to offer the A4 amendment, and hopefully procedurally it can still work.
All right. Senator Latz, the A4 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
It's on its way.
Okay. The department has indicated that in order to implement the A3 amendment that we just adopted, they feel they need to have explicit expedited rulemaking authority in order to do that. The underlying ignition interlock bill last year contained precisely the same expedited rulemaking authority to implement that that law. I ask this committee to give the department this tool to implement this as well.
Senator Latz, the commissioner that's being made reference to on line 5, which commissioner is that? Is that DPS or MnDOT?
That'd be DPS, Mr. Chairman.
DPS. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Yes, so again, with discussions with the DPS, we're okay with this amendment. They're
friendly
okay with
amendment.
This.
Any further discussion on the A4 amendment? Hearing none. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Amendment is adopted. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I would move Senate File 1082 as amended to be referred to
State government.
State government to pass.
Senate File 1082. Senator Ingebrigtsen moves that Senate File 1082 as amended be recommended to pass and go to State Government Committee. Any further discussion? Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to speak for or against the bill? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
Thank you.
Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you. Senator Gerlach, Senate File 926. Senator Gerlach, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. I know it's been a long day for you, and I think I'm the last one on the agenda, so we'll get right to it.
So that means we can take a lot of time with you. But it is Friday, and I don't want to have a mutiny on my...
5 o'clock. I understand, Mr. Chairman. Well, let me tell you what this bill is about. And we had passed this through the Commerce Committee. We referred here. This is a bill that deals with a balance between homeowners associations and individual property rights, and where do we draw the line in that balance. It's a constituent-driven bill, but is one that I hear many times about some of these issues, and I know that all of you hear about these over the years. I have a constituent, Ms. Eileen Tompkins, who actually is a former state representative years ago, and she lives in a homeowners association in Rosemount and has had a lot of difficulties with her association. She provided testimony in the Commerce Department on a range of issues, and I'll tell you, when she came in to see me, I listed out all of her issues, and we drafted up an original bill as it was introduced, and it had about half a dozen issues with it. And like we do with many of our bills, is we float it out there and we see what happens. And we had a lot of stakeholders and interested parties come in and say this doesn't work and this is a problem. So we had a stakeholders meeting. We pared the bill down to three key elements, and I'll tell you what those are. First of all, Ms. Tompkins had an issue with the restrictions of a flag on her property. And if yes, we do micromanage down to this level. As you may know, years ago, we put in statute the ability for an individual to put a flag in their yard, and that homeowners associations could not infringe on that or deny that. Well, Ms. Tompkins put a flagpole in her yard to put a flag up, and on the 4th of July, in honor of her deceased Navy husband. She was sent a letter, which she described as very unfriendly, about how she needed to take that flagpole down. And she said, I have the law on my side. It says I can put a flag up. And she was told, well, yes, but you can't put it on a flagpole. So the spirit of the law was clearly violated, and then unfortunately we have to micromanage this. And so I have in the bill a provision allowing for the use of flag poles. And we actually have an amendment, the A4 amendment. If you don't have that, we can hand that out, which is a little bit of refinement on that section. But we could, you know, hand it out now, and we can maybe take it up in a moment. But here it is right here. Or maybe you have it. But members, this that particular amendment was some language that was proposed by the Mr. Brian Lake at the Bar Association, who said that this would be a better way to craft the language that would be more workable, and they are interested in workable legislation since they advise individuals. Oh, actually, this is the A5, which is, let me take a look here. Is this the same thing?
Maybe Senator Gerlach, council has rewritten the amendment, and you have the A5 in front of you.
Okay, well, then we'll get rid of the A4, and we're going to go with the A5 then. And I want to make sure that Mr. Lake, that this A5 is if you somebody could deliver a copy to him, I'd like him to make sure that this reflects his concerns about the wording of that. And then, members, I'll just go on with the other issues, and then we can take up the amendment. So, if I could, I'll go on to the other issues.
Please proceed.
So that is the first issue. The second issue deals with the First Amendment and the free speech rights. As you know, many people like to express themselves with political campaign signs. And as you know, many associations deny this, and it's often quite a tussle about whether you can do that or not. So we have passed many laws in this legislature allowing campaign activities in apartment buildings. Senator Pappas has carried bills that we have passed along those lines for when it comes to expressing those sorts of political rights. We have passed laws in favor of the First Amendment, and this is along those lines. And we have referenced this to be a law in the same time period as is described in our campaign practices statute. There's a reference to that. That is the second component of this. And then the third component, which I'll admit is probably going to bring up the most controversy, and that is current law says that a homeowners association has the power to attach a lien to property for unpaid dues or fines. And of course, if a lien is attached to your property, that means that can lead to foreclosure. The homeowners associations would argue that is a tool, at the least, or a club, whatever you want to call it, that they need to enforce the rules of the association. And on the same hand, they'll say that we should be very careful about intervening in these homeowners associations because they're voluntary contracts. And I would argue that if it's a voluntary contract, well, then if you have someone who is not performing up to the standards of their agreement, you don't get to put a lien on their property and foreclose on their home, but rather you take them to court and you let a judge decide what the dispute is, and you get a judgment and you handle it through the courts. And that's really the main reason I think this bill is before this committee here. So I would argue that the ability of an association to attach a lien on a property and foreclose upon you for a dispute or a non-payment of some association dues is extreme and excessive, and that should not be allowed. So, members, those are the three components that are left in the bill. I think what I'd like to do, Mr. Chairman, is maybe just take care of the simple matter of the A5 amendment first. This is the second stop. It's not an author's amendment. So if that's the status of it. But if someone could move the A5 amendment, and then I think you might want to say something about it, and then we could take action on that.
Any discussion on the A5 amendment? Senator Newman moves the A5. Or Senator Jungbauer, you want to move the A5 amendment? All right.
I've heard the bill before.
The A5 amendment is before us. Any comment? Questions?
Say
Anyone in the audience that wishes to speak about the A5 amendment? Sure.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Mr. Lake.
For the record, Brian Lake with the State Bar Association. This is just some clarifying language that we had suggested to Senator Gerlach. As currently written, the flagpole provision seems to create some internal conflicts within the same section. So it's just designed to clarify, eliminate that conflict, and carry out the author's intent.
Thank you, Mr. Lake. Any further discussion? Hearing none. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? The A5 amendment is adopted. Hold on a second. Pardon me, sir. You need to get out of here. You need to get out to the audience. We'll take care of your request.
This is deep. You served too.
Yeah. You lost the people. The A5 amendment did prevail, and now we're back to the bill. Senator Jungbauer, you had a comment.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Question. Chair. And Senator Gerlach, you know, having thought through the bill after the last hearing and such exciting testimony, when we talk about the lien versus going to court and getting a judgment, you know, I was thinking through, you know, cities can attach a lien for water and different things like that. I'm just wondering if you've thought or anybody thought through language. Because I don't know if anybody's ever foreclosed on a property because of these types of liens, which we don't want to happen. Or is there a way that we can make it so that lien could still exist somewhat similar to a city, but not be the kind of lien that could cause to a full foreclosure on the property?
So, Mr. Chairman, Senator Jungbauer.
Senator Gerlach.
I'll take an attempt at that, but then also I would like Mr. Cardall, he wants to provide some testimony as well, and maybe you may want to comment on this. I think, Senator Jungbauer, a lot of that has to do with, first of all, there is an enormous distinction between a governmental entity, such as a city, and its actions and the due process involved in that, as opposed to allowing what our current law does, allowing a private entity in a contract, giving them an alternative to foreclose on a property. There's a lot of the due process is not there like it would be with the city. So there is a big distinction. Mr. Chairman, if I could, maybe could we have some testimony from Mr. Cardall, who's a real estate attorney?
Mr. Cardall, welcome to the committee. Would you identify yourself for the record?
My name is Eric Cardall, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee. And I guess due process means a meaningful hearing at a meaningful time. And the current statutes allow for different procedures. And I think the concern with this section is that we want to avoid abuse. So abuse is the origin of our concern here, is the abuse of the citizens and unnecessary lawsuits and so forth. And so with the two procedures set up in statute are for the city, as Senator Jungbauer said, that the staff prevents the city if there's been a violation. Now, there's initial protection there regarding the foreclosure you mentioned because utility bills are that way. But even that's circumscribed, that certain things you couldn't work through the assessment process on. You know, maybe if you're clearing, trees that are in the right-of-way, that you could assess under that utility bill process, but you couldn't clear the person's lawn of trees. So there's a distinction in the law between those things. Homeowners associations get more involved in property regulation than cities are allowed to under the assessment procedure we described. So that's the first step. So in a board, a homeowners association board, they're regulating the property in much different ways. We've heard about flagpoles already. A city could not use the assessment process to remove a flagpole from the property unless it was in the right of way, right? So that's a huge difference. And then when we move from the hearing before the board of the association versus the staff presenting to the city, that can be very different in that the staff presents to the city, the township, or the county their case, and then there's a quasi-judicial proceeding where the elected council makes a decision. Now, in the homeowners association board could be in that instance, the investigator, the prosecutor, and the judge, and the legislator. So you could change the board, the association rules can be changed after someone purchases the property. The board then can be very interested in enforcing that, and then they become the legislator, the investigator, the prosecutor, and the judge. Now, that's important because that doesn't have the due process aspects of the staff presentation to the city. Third, in the next step, when the city does go ahead and assess you for a violation, the citizen gets notice of appealing to the district court. So you're appealing decision of the city court regarding the violation and the fine to be paid. And normally then the League of Minnesota Cities steps in, and they then have a choice of telling the city this is when we want to fight or we're going to encourage you to settle. The Homeowners Association, there isn't even an appeal to the district court. There's no League of Minnesota Cities to help them make a good decision. Rather, what happens is they move to foreclose on the property. The citizen then brings up as a defense, you know, this fine was never justified in the first place. But there's a lot of pressure to settle. So you'd imagine a flagpole issue, you know, the lawyer says, well, it's going to cost a lot more because you're in a foreclosure proceeding, and I don't want to blow this flag issue because it's really important to you. And so we don't have the procedural protections and the Homeowners Association enforcing their rules that we have with respect to the municipalities. Now, ultimately, of course, the city can foreclose on the property for failure to pay assessments relating to violations. But you have these protections, I'll just summarize, that aren't available in the Homeowners Association way. You have a staff presenting to a city, which is supposed to sit as a quasi-judicial board in making the decision. When the citizen appeals an adverse result, the League of Minnesota Cities defends and can recommend settlement if it's a bogus case, an abuse, and then they never get to that district court level. At the appeal, you have a district court judge reviewing the issue in the first instance of, was this a violation, was it a proper fine? And then if the city wins, then you go to the foreclosure. And in the Homeowners Association situation, we have much more expansive powers regarding the regulation of property, and they themselves are passing the rules, prosecuting, judging, you go right to the foreclosure. So you're skipping really two steps, and that's why in the Homeowners Association process, you don't get a meaningful hearing at a meaningful time. Now, the opponents will say, well, this is enough. But there isn't an association of associations regulating for abuses. So when Ms. Tompkins comes forward and said, I've been abused, there isn't a League of Minnesota Cities, there isn't anyone to listen and address that abuse. So when they're not regulating themselves, then I think it's appropriate for the state legislature to do this narrow reform of saying, you've got to go through additional steps before you can foreclose on the property. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Forgot your name already.
Mr. Cardall.
Okay. I wrote all these notes. I'm trying to as we've heard in our committee here many times, the judicial system is burdened with a lot of things. So the reason I've been trying to think through all this is do I want to send something more to court? And what I'm looking for is from anybody, is there another way to do this to administrative law judge, something where the homeowner could appeal that we could put in here rather than going to something else. I don't know if there's something else available rather than, you know, going straight to a court type of judgment situation. So I'm trying to figure out again how we don't throw more things at the court, but find some avenue that exists in terms of an arbitration or somebody else that could be appealed to outside of the association board of directors.
Is that a question, Mr. Chairman? Mr. Chairman, thank you, Senator Jungbauer. I believe that it's the lack of an association of associations thinking through this, because a foreclosure is, you know, a huge lawsuit. The mortgagor gets notice and all sorts of written requirements. The landowner, if he loses, has to pay the attorney fees. I didn't mention that. That's a lot of pressure. And so I would suggest that it's the lack of the organization on the association's part to create the alternative dispute resolution processes that you describe. And why would they? They've got the foreclosure power. And so it's a great question for the industry, and the lawyers and the boards are an industry. And why aren't you encouraging ADR processes with more rights for the unit owners as opposed to retaining the foreclosure power? And I think the suggestion will be, well, we work it out. But we don't work it out in abusive situations. And what you have then is all this pressure on the landowner who's being picked on because, in Eileen Tompkins' case, she wanted to put up a flagpole. And it's just not right. There should be another level of review. And I agree that if you were to get rid of the foreclosure power, I'm sure that the Association of Associations would organize and propose some sort of alternative dispute resolution process. But the unit owners aren't in a position to do that. It would have to be, I think, the Association of Associations coming forward and saying, you know, you're right. The unit owners should have another hearing after the board's made its decision, but we don't want to go through at the expense of a civil action. Let's have a small claims court action or something like that. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, if I could also just for the record is Eileen Tompkins, she did not receive a fine. She took the flagpole down, and her avenue of handling this was to come knocking on my door and ask for clarification in the law. But not everybody, of course, has the background and the knowledge to be able to seek that redress of grievance. And so I just wanted, for the record, she wasn't fined in this particular case.
Senator Gerlach, former Representative Tompkins came and talked to me about it as well. I was hoping to have her, or I was hoping to speak with her today. But anyway, needless as that is there further discussion? Senator Lance.
Mr. Chairman, I wonder if we can have some discussion about the fee shifting provision in that in this bill as well. This is that's certainly within the jurisdiction of this committee, and we've had some discussions in the past about fee shifting issues, and this is a loser pays provision. I wonder if the Bar Association has any input on that, or if anyone else would like to explain why is it that we should deviate from the standard default position in Minnesota, which is each party carries its own legal costs, if any.
Mr. Chairman,
yes.
Committee knows more about the history and the reasons why exceptions are made in this. And I'm going to have some Mr. Cardall, maybe he wants to comment on this, and then I may defer to the wisdom of the committee if this is an appropriate use.
Senator Gerlach, I'm going to have counsel give an explanation of where this particular language may reside in other statutes.
Mr. Chairman and members, I just would observe that it's the law that's in the first section of the bill, which deals with flags, has identical language in it, so the restriction on flag language was just kind of picked up, and then now, though, it would apply to the political sign limitations as well. So,
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Gerlach, the first part of your bill regarding the flagpole, I'm fine with. The second part of the bill regarding the political signs, I've got to tell you that it seems to me that this involves private property rights, the right of people to contract. They're going to have a right to build into their covenants and restrictions whatever they want to do. So I just want you to understand, I really do not agree with this concept of requiring legislatively the ability to put in signs within this homeowner's subdivision. Now, perhaps if you were dealing with prohibiting the Department of Transportation from stealing my signs out of the ditch, I'd go along with it. But
we can add that. This the ditch, the right of way.
Yeah, it's right of way. They can steal.
More succinctly put.
Wrong record here.
but in this case, what in my mind, what you're really dealing with is private contractual rights between private parties, and all of a sudden the government is inserting themselves into that. And you're going to lose me on this. What's even, in my mind, worse is the last paragraph, which is a clause which makes the statute retroactive. And even if you were able to talk me into that, I doubt you'd be able to talk me into the retroactivity of it. So I just wanted you to know up front, in case you wanted to entertain an amendment whereby the flagpole issue would proceed for, you know, on its own, because I can tell you that unless you can really come up with some very strong arguments, in all likelihood, I would otherwise vote against the bill.
Mr. Chairman? Senator Newman? Can
Senator
I try?
Gerlach.
Let me just answer it this way. Is housing is a pretty important thing. When we talk about a lot of things on rights, you know, and health care is a right, or you know, housing and many other things are just some basic fundamental things. And you are right that there are choices that an individual can make. I would contend that the issue of the First Amendment is so fundamental that you shouldn't have to waive those First Amendment rights in order to live in a home you want. That you could agree to things like about the exterior appearance or other aspects of the home and those sorts of things, but you shouldn't have to check your First Amendment rights at the door just to live in a home. And you could say, well, yes, you can choose to live somewhere else, but you know, homeowners associations, they're not all bad, of course not. It's a growing industry. People like to have the benefits they gain by giving up certain rights. What I'm saying is the First Amendment shouldn't be one that you should have to give up.
Senator Newman?
And in response, Senator Gerlach, I would say that I don't think we can pick and choose those portions of the Constitution that we want to apply. Certainly First Amendment rights are very, very important. I do not disagree with you, but so are private property rights.
Senator Letts.
Mr. Chairman, I would suggest that any decision we made is going to pick or choose between some competing rights. And I guess it comes down to, in this kind of a case, which do we think is most important? I agree with the bill's author. I think that campaign signs during campaign season are appropriate. Democracy, it's a fundamental part of democracy. Unlike giving up the other rights that you get when you join a homeowners association. I actually had a client once who lived in an apartment building who was told she had to take her campaign sign down from the balcony. And she put it in the window. But we did have a battle with the apartment owner about the whole issue, and eventually she was allowed to put it back on the balcony during campaign season only. And it wasn't, you know, it wasn't defaced. It wasn't a messy sign or anything like that. It was a standard political campaign sign. So I think very strongly that that right is one which even a homeowners association shouldn't be able to infringe upon. And we don't want people, most people, frankly, won't read that level of detail in some of the stuff before they buy into a condo building, for example, or a townhome. They might be surprised to find out they had to check their political speech rights at the door. When they didn't even realize it, that they were doing it.
Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I'd remind Senator Newman, we certainly have stuck our nose into other issues in campaigns. And one that I never get over is allowing people to campaign in apartment buildings. And I can still tell you that in Anoka, there's an apartment manager that will not let us have access to those apartment buildings, even though the law clearly states that he has to allow us. And his answer is always, at least to Republicans, sue me, which, of course, doesn't help you get farther along in the campaign, I don't think. But I don't believe we have to check those kind of rights. However, I do agree with some of the folks that talked about issues like if you're hanging something off the balcony and now it goes beyond that, which, you know, if you're on the top floor, and I can think of some of these condos in downtown Minneapolis, and you hang a 4x8 that now infringes on the neighbor below you, I think that's wrong. But to be able to put it clearly in your window, whether you're up there and you want an airplane to see it or something, you still have purchased that property for fair use, and I believe that political speech is one of the fundamental parts of the First Amendment. So I believe you shouldn't be allowed, maybe I shouldn't even say it here, but to put it on common space because others do share and enjoy that. But certainly within your windows, keep it in the confines of your own balcony, deck, those sorts of things without making it obtrusive to others makes complete sense to me.
Senator Newman?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Latt's comments and Senator Jungbauer's comments, the difference for me is that the property owner has entered into a contract and reached an agreement before purchasing the property, whereas the examples were given, perhaps there were restrictive covenants in the association.
Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Newman, having read some of those bylaws when I did real estate and actually showed some condos in downtown Minneapolis, as Senator Latt said, I don't think people read to that level, nor do you understand to that level on some of these association bylaws. They're extremely difficult to read compared to standard contract language that's in, say, a purchase agreement for real estate. These bylaws... some get pretty extensive, and it's not supposed to be an excuse, I know, but you have to be pretty studied in bylaws to understand exactly what they mean and how they exactly reference things. So,
is there anyone else wishing to testify? Ms. Price.
It's a popular bill.
Ms. Price, Deanna Price, and that'll be followed by Phaedra Howard. And anyone who wishes to speak will have an opportunity to speak before we leave, and even before we make a decision. Ms. Price, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Deanna Price. I am with New Concepts Management Group, and I am speaking today on behalf of CSE Midwest, which is a division of the Multi-Housing Association. I want to start by thanking Senator Newman for making the point about private contractual rights versus government intervention. And point out that when people purchase real estate in a common interest community, that they are, or that they have reached an agreement before purchasing this property and are aware of the governing documents and the rules and regulations, these people have chosen to purchase this property and should understand what they are getting into. Architectural controls are extremely important within a common interest community, both for appearance purposes, for preserving uniformity within the association, but also to preserve property values. And I know in this day and age we are all very concerned about economic well-being and with the real estate market. And preserving property values protects members, helps preserve the property values, and enhance enjoyment of the property. And people buy into these associations and communities for this reason. A point was brought up earlier about the right to appeal if a rule is violated and a fine is imposed. That right to appeal is part of Minnesota State Statute 515B already. Sorry, I've lost my train of thought for a moment. The decision should be left to the individual associations, and I don't believe it should be left to the legislature to decide. Specifically regarding Section 1 that deals with the flagpole provisions. Ms. Tompkins, who was the proponent for this bill with Senator Gerlach, lives in a single-family home association and not in a condominium or a townhome, which the vast majority of units that are in CICs are. And allowing these flagpoles to be erected in any portion of the CIC that the homeowner has exclusive use of, which could include decks, balconies, patios, even garage stalls, would be detrimental or could be detrimental to the both appearance and the structural integrity of these buildings. Just a minute ago, Senator Jungbauer had brought up, in relation to the signs, the infringing on neighbors below or above or whatnot, and imagine if a 30-foot flagpole was erected on a balcony or whatnot, certainly that could affect a neighbor above or below. So... I just ask that the individual associations be allowed to make decisions about the architectural controls of their associations. Thank you.
Okay. Senator Gerlach?
Mr. Chairman, if I could just respond to one thing, because the issue of the 30-foot flagpole or those other things that would infringe on other people's area, well, that's clearly on its face value not supported by this law, because you are infringing on other people's areas. Just because you're allowed to put up a flag, well, does not mean you can, or a flag, it doesn't mean you can do that. So on its face value, you can't violate other people's rights.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Any other testimony?
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Phaedra Howard. I'm an attorney with Helmuth & Johnson. I've been practicing in the area of community, primarily in the area of community association law, for approximately 10 years. I'm here representing CIC Midwest along with Ms. Price. I am also here as a member of the Cooperative Network, and they fully support our position and oppose this bill in its entirety. Ms. Price talked about the architectural control and the ability of the association to determine what items do and do not fit along with the association's scheme and plan, that should be determined by the association. The association sets those rules not just for architectural control, but for safety to enhance the values of the property. When a homeowner violates those rules, the association needs an effective means to be able to enforce those rules. Currently, the primary and best, most effective mean is for the ability to lien the property for fines. You can fine the person, but then how do you make them pay the fines? You have a lien against the property. That puts a bitter stake into them to force them to comply. We're not talking about just a situation. You know, Ms. Tompkins had a situation, and frankly, from what I understand, you know, her rules, and it's in every declaration that I have seen in my experience, it's not just in the rules, but it's in the declaration. The covenants that are recorded against the property set forth the architectural controls and specify that if a homeowner wants to make a change to their property or to the common areas near their property, that they submit a plan to the association and they get approval for that. It's my understanding Ms. Tompkins did not submit a plan, and that's why she was in violation. If she had done so, we don't know where we'd be today. If she'd actually gone to her board and said, I would like to put this up, can I? But we're not talking about just the Ms. Tompkins of the world. We're talking about people who store flammable materials when they're not supposed to, that, you know, flick cigarette butts off their balcony, have, you know, big, huge dogs that attack their neighbors, things along those lines. And it can be any litany of things. You know, you enter into an association, you buy into it for the purpose of preserving the values, as my colleague has stated. And so the association needs to have an effective means for enforcing those rules. If you take away the lien rights, they really have no ability to enforce their rules, then homeowners can do whatever they want. There is due process set forth for these, as my colleague explained, within the statute, before an association can levy a fine for a violation or take certain other actions, they have to give notice and an opportunity for a hearing. Homeowners request a hearing. They come before the board of directors. The board hears them out and then makes a final decision. You know, if they determine that a violation has occurred, then they obviously have the right to levy a lien or levy a fine that then becomes a lien against the property. By taking away that right, we're basically putting the concerns of the rule violators ahead of the concerns of the rest of the community by letting them get away with violating the rules and having really no real consequences to that. So for these reasons, CIC Midwest and the Cooperative Network are strongly opposed to this bill.
Thank you. Any questions? Anyone else wishing to give testimony before or after? Sir, back here. And Ms. Hilden, you'll be next. Welcome to the committee.
Yes, I am Gene Rexical, manager of Rex Rentals in Apple Valley, Minnesota. I'm having an experience with Network Management, who is an association, and they are trying to put a lien and foreclose on one of my rental units, which is one that I own and manage, because I did not comply with letting them seize my lease to my renter, and also they're trying to fine me for not turning over my papers. Now, basically, the association, in my point of view, is violating our First Amendment rights, our Fourth Amendment rights, and our Fifth Amendment rights. And as a legislature body, you take an oath of office to protect those rights to all the people. And that includes landlords and property owners from associations. Because the new association is like another form of government. You pay dues, and they're supposed to represent you according to the bill rights.
Sir, are you speaking in favor or in opposition to this bill?
I am in favor of the bill, and in the sense that associations should not be able to foreclose on property, no matter if the landowner is under the protection of the First, Fourth, and Fifth Amendment of the Bill of Rights of the United States of America.
All right.
And I would believe that the legislative body here would support that statement I just made.
Okay. Any questions for the testifier? Thank you for your testimony. Ms. Hilden?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Gerlach. Nancy Hilden with Fager and Benson. I'm here tonight on behalf of Gasson Properties. They are a company which represents roughly 50,000 units across the, I will call it the greater metro 13-county area. I appreciate very much Senator Gerlach's clarification that Ms. Tompkins' flag issue was not related to the fine and lien issue in the third section. That's what I'm speaking against right now, because based on the conversation that I've had with my client, there's a lot of anecdotes that we hear about somebody who's been a good actor who is abused by the association, when in fact these fines are most, by a lot, most often really the bad actors or somebody really doing something that's wrong. And so what this will tend to do is shift the ability to the bad actors to avoid paying fines or being accountable for their actions. So I would ask you to not support this language. And I do appreciate Senator Gerlach's willingness to try to find some kind of an alternative for second deadline. But barring that, we believe this language, as it stands now, really does shift against all the good actors, who are those folks who have agreed to play by the rules. The deal's the deal, and really puts it in the hand of some of the bad actors. And admittedly, there are a few anecdotes where that's not the case, but we would simply say that what you're suggesting really shifts away from the ability to control some bad activities. So that's all I would say.
Thank you. Senator Gerlach.
Mr. Chairman, and Ms. Hilden got some late notice from her client, and she is ably representing the interests of her client. And she did catch me about 10 minutes before the bill was up, and because it was late, and I said, I don't know if your issues are, well, actually, I'm not sure you had a really good grasp of exactly what could be done. And I said, at this late time, I said, what it sounds to me like the issues are more about police enforcement than anything dealing with what a whole association could do. But what I did say was that should this bill pass this committee, it would meet first deadline, and then there would be some time to explore those issues with no guarantees, but it would be a chance for you to research more of what the objections might be, and that we could attempt to come up with something for the second deadline.
All right. Thank you.
If I may add one more thing.
Ms. Hilden.
This was just really, Mr. Chair, as I was sitting and thinking about some of this, in fact, what the associations really create is a form of alternative dispute resolution. Maybe not recognized in court, but you're electing your peers amongst your ownership or organization to make determinations about what's right and wrong and what is abiding by the rules you've agreed to abide by. And if that's not alternative dispute resolution, I don't know what is. It's outside the court process, but it is a form of resolving disputes. So with that, I do thank you very much for your last 11th hour moment here to express some concerns.
Any other discussion? Anyone in the audience who wishes to speak, please proceed to the table. Would you identify yourself for the record?
Sure. My name is Mark Gittleman. I'm president of Gittleman Management. We're in the community association management business. And I wanted to speak against the legislation. I'm against all three parts of the legislation, and I'm speaking on behalf of our company. I am also a former president of the Community Association Institute, a national organization with the Minnesota chapter. I am not speaking on their behalf here today, but I served on the board for 3 years. I am not going to add to the comments that have been made about nonconforming use restrictions or exceptions with regard to flagpoles or signs. I'm opposed to those provisions. The provision, however, that I'm most concerned about fundamentally and functionally for the ability of community associations to be governed is the lien provision. I think it fundamentally and adversely impacts community associations and their ability to govern their affairs. I wish to give a couple of examples so you can visualize this that are unrelated to nonconforming uses such as signs and flagpoles. And I think Senator Jungbauer made some very apt comments about the potential burdens that this may put on municipal court systems, be it conciliation court systems or district court appeals. Specifically, our company manages about an even balance of condominium and townhome associations. And if we think a little bit about condominium associations, where there's common property where people are interacting with each other on a much more intimate level, as opposed to a flagpole in a townhome setting, we have people who play very loud music at times. We have people who have barking dogs that bark all night long and keep up hardworking people who are trying to sleep to get ready for work the next day. We have people who've never lived in a condominium before, who have bought their first home and simply have not matured to a level to know how to handle themselves in consideration of their neighbors. There are some associations that are small and have very mature people and are very calm and have very few violations that are very fundamentally disruptive to their neighbors. There are other associations that are larger, wonderful communities, urban, vibrant, suburban, vibrant. There's people coming and going, a lot of interaction. And in those associations, it is not uncommon to have a small number of people create enormous problems. And there can be repetitive violations and fundamental disruptions. If a board responds to that out of concern for their neighbors, if there's a party in the middle of the night that's taking place in the hallway and keeping up 10 people, and they wish to respond to that by levying a fine against a unit owner for a couple $100, if the imposition and the burden is on the board of directors to go to conciliation court or file some type of other judicial action to collect the $200, the board is going to choose not to do that, or to do that only in the most extreme circumstances, because boards of directors don't have the resources to do that, and it would substantially increase their expenses to hire an attorney every time an action was required. And frankly, management companies aren't in a position to provide legal representation through the complexity of the judicial process. So in many of these cases, attorneys would have to be hired, and simply that would add a lot of expense to homeowners and would make it so that many boards would choose to live with a lot of disruptive problems. I think another factor in all of this is in many associations, you have a lot of tenants living in condominiums and in townhomes. And in some cases, those tenants don't have a vested interest in the property. Many are wonderful tenants, some are not. And if they're creating problems and disruptions, and that owner of the unit needs to be held accountable for their proper behavior, but there's no way for the association to force that unit owner to step up to the table and pay a fine, the association's at a fundamental disadvantage in its ability to govern its affairs. I don't wish to go on and on about it, but I did want to provide that example so that you can visualize some of these problems, be it loud music, barking dogs, very disruptive behavior in common areas, abuse of facilities after hours, drunken behavior in a swimming pool that potentially raises a liability risk, all those types of circumstances, and the importance of the association's ability to respond. Thank you for your time.
Senator Gerlach.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think that Mr. Gittleman really helps to make my point, and that is that all of those matters that he brought up, the loud music, the parties, the pets, the dogs, etc., those are police matters. Those are not matters that you wait till the following monthly board meeting to assess a fine. You call the police. You do what everybody would do when there is nuisance, noise, problems like that. You call the police. It's clearly a matter. That's a matter. And that's what I would say to that.
Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Gittleman, I guess anybody could come back up. I'm still trying to understand this whole lien process. You know, 25 years in building and in real estate, and I understand my mechanics lien rights, those sorts of things. But I guess it kind of gets down to me, whether you leave lien in or take it out, is how often do people use the lien process, and, you know, how much does it have to be as a lien before somebody starts, or what is the threshold before somebody starts using a foreclosure on them, those liens?
May I answer the question? Knowledge that a lien is a possibility is an issue that many homeowners are aware of and informed about so that they understand the gravity of being fined and not paying. Actual going to the lien foreclosure process over a violation is very uncommon. It does happen, but it is a small percentage of, very small percentage of fines that are levied. Most homeowners that are fined understand what they've done. Many agree with the fine and understand that they erred. Some disagree with the fine but accept it reluctantly. A very small number of people don't pay fines and run it all the way through a lien process. And in addition, many associations have stipulations that $25 or $50 would not only not be the basis for a lien but isn't even the basis for a late fee, that fines can be carried and in some cases are carried with no consequences if they're relatively small fines until the unit sells, and then the unit owner has an obligation to clear the amount due and owing at the time of sale. And briefly, with regard to police matters, I wholeheartedly agree with Senator Gerlach with regard to the appropriateness of calling police in those matters. The reality is, when the police come, though, trying to get anything more than a 2 or 3 hour delayed nuisance response from the police on a nuisance call in a busy city or municipality is unlikely to happen unless there's such serial conduct that's repeatedly happening. There isn't likelihood of follow-up action and any kind of disciplinary action. Usually it's an immediate emergency response, and that doesn't satisfactorily address the problem. The other thing is, when these things get too out of control and we have repeat police calls to the same association, if they're ongoing, the police stop coming, which is a problem. And in addition, the association develops a history that adversely impacts the real estate value because of a bad history of police coming to the property, all of which is publicly available information. So I support your notion that the police should be called, but I don't think that that remedies and is in conflict with what I'm suggesting.
Thank you. Any other discussion? Senator Lantz.
Mr. Chairman, I have a question. The ability of the homeowners association to lien against the property, is that a function of the contract, the association rules and bylaws? I mean, if someone buys into the association, are they essentially agreeing to those terms of enforcement if they violate the rules and get a fine against them? Or is there some other basis for that enforcement mechanism?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Latz, the basis of the mechanism is that the state law allows for that. That's what it is. That's what we're talking about. We're not intervening in the contract. We've had a lot of discussion about that this is a contract, but then we have state law that allows for this additional hammer to be used in addition to what normally, if there was a contract and you weren't and one side didn't perform, you'd go to court and have a judge rule on that. In this case, we allow one side, through state law, the additional hammer of the foreclosure process, or the lien.
Mr. Chairman, a follow-up?
Yes, Senator Lantz.
And maybe Mr. Gittleman can answer this question. Typically, in homeowners association rules or bylaws, or is there repeated? Does it become part of the contract as well, or is it not even mentioned in the rules and bylaws of the homeowners association? This enforcement mechanism.
I might have to turn to Patrick to answer that question because he's an attorney. But typically, I believe it's certainly referenced in the Minnesota Common Interest Ownership Act, and I think cross-referenced in the declaration in terms of the lienability of assessments. Typically in the declaration, it would not typically be in the rules or the bylaws, but in the association's declaration, which is recorded against the property. I don't know if you wish to comment on that, Patrick.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
yes.
For the record,
identify yourself.
My name is Patrick Hines. It's spelled H-Y-N-E-S. I am a member of the Community Association Institute and am speaking on their behalf in opposition to the bill. In response to the question, I think that Mr. Gittleman's testimony is accurate. The power of the lien comes from MCIOA's Statute 515B. A declaration or bylaws will likely reference that. Rules and regulations may or may not reference the actual lien, so it is a creature of statute, as all the condominiums only exist because statute allows them, so all of their powers come from there.
Thank you. Any other discussion? Anyone else wishing to speak for or against the bill? Ma'am? You'll be next.
Should I sit here? I don't wish to speak. My name is Ray Anderson. I didn't even know that you were doing this, and now I do wish to speak. I am appalled at Gittleman Management and have had to deal with them for 7 or 8 years. Had no idea they were here. Glad to be here. My parents at age 77 and 83 got married. They went to Rotland Homes and bought Rotland Homes, at County Road I and 35W. Rotland Homes had an agreement with Gittleman Management before there ever was a chance to discuss the situation. Besides, they're 83 and 77. They thought somebody had done it for them. The person marketing Rotland Homes made it sound like Gittleman was an excellent management. We had no idea they would tell us no flagpole, no political signs, the size of your dog, no gas. You had to have a gas grill that could blow up the whole place, but you couldn't have a little teeny charcoal grill and grill your fish in the middle of your asphalt by your garage. Okay. Poison on the lawn, bleeding. Actually happens if you put a certain kind of poison on your lawn. So they were nice enough to say we didn't have to poison our lawn. We have had problem after problem. The person managing this particular townhouse association for Gittleman is named Kristen. The joke of the day is, have you called Kristen about this? And people just laugh. Because you can't ever find Kristen, she might call back 2 weeks later. If you're going to have a foreclosure on a townhouse, and if the bank is going to foreclose, they should both foreclose together, not separately. The townhouse, both of my parents have died. We rented the townhouse. It's underwater. They bought it for $159,000. They were evaluated. One little handicapped accessible townhouse was evaluated at $239,000. They're now selling for $140,000, I think. $149,000. It's a very disturbing situation. Anyway, My parents moved out. They moved to an actual house. We rented the townhouse, and what happened next was that the renter moved out because the townhouse was underwater. We couldn't pay the mortgage. So no mortgage has been paid since 2008. So the mortgage company has every right to foreclose. We can't pay it. The problem is when Gittleman foreclosed through the Townhouse Association, they knew our address because they sent a bill there for the association fees every month. They filed a lien in some little ledger my mom probably couldn't have read, didn't know where it was. They had our address and did not send us that foreclosure. I moved into the property after calling Bank of America, asking them if they were going to foreclose. They said, we are going to foreclose. You can move into the property. Then Gittleman foreclosed. They have a lien against this property, and they foreclosed April 7th. Then the bank is foreclosing March 24th. I don't have any disagreement with, you know, foreclosures. I don't like them. But having to work with Gittleman has been one of the most, I thought I was living in a communist country. No flagpole, no Christmas lights, poison on our lawn. My mom, of course, would not go to the association meetings because I can't speak up. They have attorneys. They have a preset plan. Elderly people have not a chance in the world to deal with these people. They're concerned about themselves, not the elderly. I could absolutely cry telling you what my parents have been through with this association.
Miss Anderson? Miss Anderson?
There is one more thing, if you don't mind.
Miss Anderson, I'm assuming you're speaking in favor of the bill?
I'm saying that the
you haven't come to that part of
the association has way too much power. They're hired. We tried to get rid of Gittleman, and five people that go to the meetings all the time kept them because they keep it easy for the association. People don't go to these meetings because they're afraid to speak out. People that live in associations live in a communist country. You need to help them. They need to be able to understand, yes, the contract. And then they need to know how to fight against it. And they need to be properly notified. And they need to plan whether or not they want this kind of covenant. But when the person who builds the townhouses and the Gittleman Company get together, the homeowner doesn't have any rights at all.
Thank you for your comments.
You're welcome.
Senator Gerlach.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and appreciate the testimony, Ms. Anderson. It sounds like your particular situation, unfortunate, hopefully you get some resolution on that. I just wanted
It's fine.
Okay. I wanted to point out, members, the purpose of this bill is it's not an indictment of homeowners associations, and it's not an indictment of the quality of management companies. I'm not. That's not what this bill is about. This bill is about the fundamental principle of the balance of power in balance between the collective rights of those who enter into this contract versus the waiver of your other property rights and other constitutional rights and such. It's about the balance there, and I really didn't want to get into any specifics on any particular management companies or anything. So I just wanted
to
clarify.
We only know
that.
One of them.
Okay.
Is there anyone else wishing to testify? Yeah. Sir, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is Gene Sullivan, and I'm a president of New Concepts Management, a property management company that manages homeowner associations. I'm also a member of the Institute of Real Estate Management, Community Associations Institute. I'm a board member there, a member of the CIC Midwest, part of the Minnesota Multi-Housing Association. But I'm here today representing my company that is involved in the management of homeowner associations. I am in opposition of Bill 926 for a number of the reasons that many of my colleagues have mentioned here earlier today. Another one that I think is very important is I see this bill as being a prohibition in allowing an individual property, a privately owned corporation, to be able to manage and govern their own affairs. A homeowners association is formed and is recognized by the state of Minnesota as a corporation, first and foremost, a nonprofit corporation. And that nonprofit corporation develops its bylaws, its rules, its regulations, its covenants, its agreements on how they're going to interact as a corporation. I think it's important to remember that Minnesota state law also provides that any homeowner, prior to purchasing in a homeowners association, is required to have a 10-day right of rescission to be able to read those governing documents prior to the purchase of that property. And if they are presented with those governing documents 5 days before the closing takes place, and for any reason they realize that they don't want to purchase because of something onerous in those documents, they can pull away from the purchase of that home. Now, I will agree with Senator Youngbauer that purchase of a home certainly involves a lot of very important documents and numbers that, frankly, probably not enough people pay attention to them as they should. But that, again, is a choice of the individual who is purchasing that piece of property. I've always been amazed in the 25 years that I've been in this business, more people seem to spend their time researching the next TV set that they're going to get and their cell phone more than they will the governing documents of that piece of property that they're going to buy. But that is a choice that they have. And so I think this bill is wrong for those reasons. I don't think that we need to be involved in prohibiting how a privately held corporation is going to act any more than the state would be involved in if one shareholder in Target was upset with the way things are run in Target. That is between that corporation, and in this case, that corporation is the homeowners association, and there's plenty of information allowed to that homeowner prior to the purchase, and they're asked to sign off on that. So if it was something that they were not, that they did not agree to, they would not have to purchase. An example, my wife and I do live in a homeowners association. Pets are very important to us. We looked at a number that didn't allow for pets, for people to have pets and own that home. We chose not to purchase that home. That was our decision. We found an association that did allow pets, and we're quite happy with that decision.
Thank you. Anyone else wishing to testify? Anyone else wishing to testify? Any further discussion on the bill?
If not, Mr. Chairman, I'd maybe offer a couple of closing comments, and then we could take action.
Senator Lott.
Mr. Chairman and members, we've heard a lot of testimony, and this did take a lot longer than I had intended, but I want to make sure we focus in on the central issue here. I believe that the opponents of this legislation want to have it two ways. They want you to believe that it's a contract, a voluntary contract, that is entered in between these homeowners and the association, and that the state ought not intervene. And you know, they can make that argument regarding the first two provisions of the bill that we've talked about, and we've talked about that balance about rights and such. But when it comes to the lien portion, that lien portion is not part of that contract. It's backed up by state law. We, the state, allow in our statute one side of the parties to the contract to have a nuclear bomb and the other side doesn't. And what I'm saying is, even it out. If it's truly a contract, then those parties, if one of them, if there's a dispute, you use the city ordinances for safety or health or noise issues. You use the police. You use those appropriate measures that are in place. And then if you cannot resolve the issue, you take it to court and you get a judgment. That is what we have, the system in place. We don't have one side with nuclear weapons and the other side not. So I'm asking that you even that out. To Senator Jungbauer's some great insight on, is there a middle ground on some kind of arbitration? Maybe, but I don't know. This bill doesn't address that. I would say we should pass this bill and then have the Homeowners Association propose a model, and then maybe we can talk about it, that has the due process considerations in there that are lacking in today's system, and let them propose that, and I'll even consider authoring something like that. But right now, today, that's not the issue before us. So, members, I would appreciate your support on this bill.
Thank you. Do we have a motion? Senator Hoffman moves. Senate File 926 as amended be recommended to pass. Further discussion?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator Letts.
I'm of two minds on this bill, honestly. I like the provisions relating to the flagpoles and the political campaign signs. I'm a little more troubled about the lien provision. I know that there's now a motion on the table, but I guess my own inclination here would be to seek to remove the lien provisions from the bill and just let the flag and campaign sign provisions move forward.
Well, Senator Letts, I asked a couple times for further discussion, and then we went into the motion.
I've been thinking about this. I came in here without any predispositions on right. The lien side of it, been muddling through this, trying to balance the priorities as I weigh them. So I wonder, maybe the correct question is to ask if Senator Hoffman would withdraw her motion, allow me to make a motion to strike the lien provisions. If not, I guess I'll just deal with that.
You can. Senator Hoffman says no.
Well, then I'll offer an amendment to her motion.
All right. You can do that. What's your motion? Or your amendment?
It would be to
amend the bill.
To strike the lien provisions that are in the bill.
I have been told by counsel that amending the bill is a higher motion.
Right. So you can amend the bill.
So we will withdraw Senator.
Vote on the amendment first.
We'll vote on the amendment first?
Yeah.
All right. State your amendment, Senator Lance.
Well, I think the proper amendment would be to delete Section 3.
Senator Latz moves to delete language in Section 2. Okay.
Three.
Oh, 3. I'm sorry, 3. And that's the whole section, Senator Latz?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, it's a long section, but that's because the statute provision is long.
That's correct.
It's only a 3-line.
The real language is found on lines page 3.4 through 8. Everyone understand the amendment? Any further discussion?
Mr. Chairman, can I comment on that?
Yes, Senator Gerlach.
I would strongly urge members not to adopt the Latz amendment. That is obviously the key component in the bill. And as I said strongly in my summation, that I believe that it's a matter of justice for the court to determine this dispute and not to give one party the nuclear weapon. And that's why I believe that state law should be silent on that and let the parties be equal in their dispute.
May I inquire on that?
Senator Latz.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Gerlach, typically within a homeowners association, is there any kind of a process for dealing with a proposal to implement a fine? I mean, if I'm an owner in the condominium association and the management company proposes to fine me, do I have a right to appeal that decision to the board of the Homeowners Association, for example? Rights embedded in the statute?
Mr. Chairman, if I...
Senator Gerlach,
I think the council
might be able to give us some comment, but why don't you...
Certainly, Mr. Chairman and Senator Latz, I think I can simply answer that, and I would say yes. I don't know the specifics. I'm sure that out of the many varied homeowners association models and structures that are out there, I have no doubt that probably all have some sort of an appeal process, something along those lines. But again, I would say that when it comes to home ownership and having a group turn you out of your home, that is insufficient to rely on for due process, that the level of gravity of the situation is far more important, and that's why I believe that rather than relying on a board of a homeowners association when it comes to foreclosure, that the issue should be settled in a court of law.
Mr. Chairman, I wonder if Ms. Pontius can comment on whether MCAO, the statute, provides for any kind of appeal, or is it the board of the Homeowners Association only that has the authority to levy the fine and not the management company? And then my second question is whether that would involve or include the monthly dues, rather than just a rule violation like a loud dog or something like that, but whether failure to pay dues would be included in the provisions in the bill.
Ms. Pontius?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Latz, the language that I found is just in the general powers of the association. It says that it can impose interest and late charges for late payment of assessments, and then after notice and an opportunity to be heard before the board or a committee appointed by it, levy reasonable fines for violations.
So, Mr. Chair, it sounds like it's not the management company ultimately, but it's the board that would levy the fine. The management company may recommend it. It would go to the board, I assume, for a decision, and then the board decides whether or not to levy the fine, and at that board hearing, the property owner or occupant could make a presentation and say, hey, I didn't really do it, or it was inadvertent, I'm sorry, or whatever, and then the board makes a decision. I'm seeing heads in the audience nod that that'd be the typical process.
Ms. Pontius?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Senator Latz, yes, it would be the board or a committee appointed by it.
Okay. So it sounds like that would also apply then to for being arrears in the assessments. Or is there a different process for that?
It looks like that.
I mean, in the monthly dues, association dues.
Mr. Chairman, I think the notice and opportunity to be heard language, I believe, modifies just levying the fines, which this bill is about. So it does say they can impose interest and late charges. And then it says, and after notice and an opportunity to be heard before the board or a committee, levy reasonable fines.
Okay, so this is only applying to fines. So for association dues that are due every month, this bill would not change the ability of the board to use a lien to collect those?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Senator, that's correct. This bill only carves out fines.
Senator Latz has his motion before us. Any further discussion?
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator Marty.
I apologize because I missed much of the discussion on this, but just real quickly from Senator Gerlach, are these fines tending to be bigger or smaller than charges, late charges? I mean, if your thing passes, wouldn't the association simply say, well, we're going to just put in some new charges? I mean, why can't they... Wouldn't they get around it, and so they could put a lien on a late charge, and you just, well, we'll charge you a lot, and we won't fine you. We'll just charge you more. I'm not sure I disagree with the provision in the bill. I'm just trying to get a sense of, because the lien is a fairly potent way to go after somebody for what might be a small deal, but Are these fines, is the problem that fines are sometimes much larger than the charges, or they're more arbitrary, or?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Marty, now the
Senator Gerlach.
The issue isn't about what the fines are or the dues. It's the, right. the point of the bill is when there is a dispute,
Civil court, who
decides? And what I'm arguing is that it's very lopsided, and that's the point. To Senator Latz's points, however, my intention is that any dues or fines that would be in this would be considered the same. But you may have exposed a gap in my intentions here, which I'll have to take a look at. But I don't know that we want to necessarily fix that now. But my intention is not just the fines, but dues and fines.
Any further discussion?
We'll see if the provision remains in the bill.
Senator Jungbauer? Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, if the provision remains in the bill, I'll want to pursue that. If it comes out of the bill, which I hope it doesn't, but if it does, then I guess it'll be a moot point.
Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm going to speak against the amendment. And this is the second committee I've heard this in, and I took extensive notes on what we're talking about. And because of Senator Gerlach's willingness to work on some kind of an alternative dispute resolution, I just there's something that still speaks ill to me when all the power is on one side and not that there's not a lot of balance to what's going on here. So I'm speaking against the amendment, but I would love to work with folks out there that want to come up with something that might have a different balance to it.
Any further discussion? Hearing none on the Latz amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No. Aye.
The amendment fails. Senator Hoffman renews her motion when Senate File 920. I can't even remember the motion now. Senator Hoffman moves at Senate File 926. As amended, be recommended to pass and go to the floor. Further discussion? Hearing none. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. There's no further business before the committee. The meeting is adjourned.